BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway today is the shepherd and writer James Rebanks. His family have been farming in the Cumbrian Fells for over 600 years, and he's firmly rooted in the land. His skills and knowledge have been passed down through the generations, and the farming life began early for him. As a toddler, he rode on the back of his grandfather's tractor, and as he grew, he'd increasingly help out with the daily tasks of clipping, dipping, feeding, and mucking out. His other career as a best-selling author was inspired by his discovery of social media. Tweeting pictures of his beloved Herdwick sheep and his sheepdogs brought him to the attention of publishers. The Shepherd's Life was a huge success and brought the reality of life on the hills to townies across the world. He says, "I have always liked the feeling of carrying on something bigger than me, something that stretches back through other hands and other eyes into the depths of time. To work there is a humbling thing. It liberates you from any illusion or self-importance." James Rebanks, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
So when I think of the Lake District, what comes to mind first is the fantastic smell of it. When I arrive and get out of the car, that beautiful, mulchy, mossy... Actually, I'm such a terrible townie, I don't even know what it is I'm smelling. But I wondered if you did. What is that?
The first thing that's going through my head is, no, I don't think it smells, because that's my normal. So I'd probably, if I went to Sunderland or somewhere, I'd probably notice that the smell's very different. But,
oh, you would.
But yeah, maybe at this time of year, I can imagine what you're talking about, which is there's a lot of woodland in our valley, and it does smell very damp and leafy and probably mouldy. And yeah, but mostly it just smells clean to me.
It's definitely a clean smell. So many of us, of course, know the lakes through our holidays. Millions visit every year. How would you describe the landscape that you're rooted in?
I think the Lake District's a really special place. It's not only beautiful in the natural sense with its geology and its lakes and things, but it has a very unique farming culture that goes back like 5,000 odd years. No one really knows, at least 1,000 years. And I didn't realise that that was unique, really. I just grew up in it. It's what my granddad did, what my dad did. And it's only really when I got into my late teens and my 20s and realised how different we were from lots of other people and different from the people that came on holiday there and started to think about that, that you realise how special it is. So I think, like my kids, I've got 4 kids at home, and I think they just take it for granted. They think everybody lives with a really beautiful view and sheep around the house and things. But no, I'm aware we're very, very lucky to live in that place.
So your sheep, if I wanted to buy one, I know I would need some guineas, but I'm wondering what else I would need to look for.
You look for a mix of understandable, sensible things that sheep needs in the mountains. So it needs really, really short teeth, because the first thing that gives up on a sheep when it's old is its teeth become too long and they fall out. And then you die if you're a sheep in a really hard mountain environment. They need a really tight, hard, weather-turning coat. And they need to be very mobile, so they need really good legs. But because people have done this for a very long time, there's a whole culture, a shepherding culture emerged on that, that says that they have to be a certain kind of white in the head, sort of brilliant, pure snow white, and the fleece should be a sort of slaty blue colour, like the slates in the Lake District on the roofs.
So yeah. There's an aesthetic that's started to develop alongside the practical.
And shepherds are as geeky about what their sheep look like as other people are about punk music or Picassos or whatever else. You get me and 2 or 3 of my friends together looking at the perfect sheep and we can talk for hours about it.
Well, exactly. I mean, I know you're a sheep nerd. Now, tell me about your sheep dogs, because I know that they're working dogs rather than pets.
Yeah, so we have Floss and Tan, and then we have their daughters Meg and Nell and Bess. And what's the relationship? Well, they're keeping me in business, basically. I can't do anything without them. So if you go into a mountain in the Lake District and you try to chase 300 sheep down to a farm without dogs, you're going to look like a complete fool. And there's no technology, there's no quad bike or drone or anything that's going to do that. The sheep are too smart, they know the landscape, they're not going to fall for any of that nonsense. And it's basically dog and stick farming. It's a very, very old-fashioned way of farming poor land, really.
You're sharing the music that you love with us today. Tell me about your first disc. Why have you chosen this one?
Okay, so I've chosen Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme from Paganini, and it's pure and simply because one of my first memories when I was maybe 6 or 7 is my mum playing this record. My mum was what my dad would have called an import or a foreigner. She was from as far away as industrial Lancashire. So half of my family were cotton workers.
Which is how far away from where you are?
Oh, crazy distance, but like 50, 60 miles or something like that.
50 to 60 miles
from, this was the definition of foreigner in my childhood. So my mum's family had been cotton mill workers, and they'd sort of climbed out with some pretty poor, hard conditions. And they'd really done it through education. And I'm a funny mix of those two things, really, that farming culture and the sort of bookish culture that my mum would bring into the house. So as I'm trying to go to sleep at night when I'm sort of 7 or 8 years old, I thought it was my mum playing this, but my mum laughs at this memory and says she was actually playing it on the record, not playing it on the piano. So who knows who was playing it, but it's a beautiful piece of music and it reminds me of my mum.
Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, played by Cecile Housset with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. So, James Rebanks, you currently look after around 400 sheep, is that right?
We have about 400 yows, and then we have the young stock or followers, as we would call them, so there's about 600 and something sheep in total.
Okay, and yows meaning?
Yows is ewes in the south of England.
Oh, so, right, okay. Yeah.
So nearly all the terminology of what we do is sort of Viking or Old English, because the sheep and the shepherds were more or less Vikings 1,000 years ago.
So you are out there in all weathers all year round. I wonder which is your preferred season?
The truth is I'm head over heels in love with the landscape where I live and the work that I do, so I love all the seasons. I don't really have a favourite. I love lambing time in the spring. It can be really hard if you get some late snow showers, but that's an amazing thing to do, just to get up every morning and know that if you do your job right, you keep sheep alive, and if you do it wrong, they'll die. I mean, I also love the autumn, because that's when our work comes to fruition. That's where we sell the sheep that we've put all this effort for decades into trying to breed the perfect sheep. That's when it goes public, if you like, and we all go to the sales and the shows, and you try and prove that you're a good shepherd by turning out these fantastically healthy, fantastically beautiful sheep that meet the aesthetic that we were talking about. My wife Helen says I go slightly crazy. She calls it tup fever in the autumn, where you slightly lost it because you're so in the zone with this thing that you
love. It's all you're thinking about.
Yeah.
So you mentioned being a sheep nerd and how nerdy shepherds can be about sheep. I mean, I've read that you can tell sheep from each other, but also that you can see the kind of family history of the sheep a little bit that you're looking at.
Yeah, so we're talking full on nerdy, like other people are nerdy about other things. And this isn't even surprising to shepherds, by the way. This is not some unique attribute of mine. So if you point to one of my sheep, I can tell you what its mother was, what its father was. I can tell you what it's bred in the preceding 3, 4, 5, 10 years, and which other sheep in the flock it's related to. And this is not some sort of weird showing off for shepherds. It's actually really important, because the genetics of the different families in the flock matter. And just like other people would have a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of records and things from the 1970s, the great sheep from the 1970s are spoken about and remembered. And there is a whole series of books. There are sort of flock books where the photographs from every year going back to the 1920s or of the important sheep are captured.
And another piece of terminology, they are hefted, your sheep. They roam the unfenced fells and they don't stray. Why not?
So the key thing to understand, which a lot of people don't get, is that the sheep don't have to be flocked together with a shepherd around them like you would see in the Mediterranean. There aren't any large natural predators on those mountains, so the sheep disperse there and they find a specific place on the mountain, which is their heath, we would call it. And when they go back to the fell or the mountain in the spring, they take their lambs with them. And the really weird bit is that the sheep have a culture. The sheep teach their daughters that this is our place on the mountain, this is the place you must come back to every spring. So I can go to a certain place on the mountain not far from where we live, and before we get there I can tell you which one of the sheep will be there, and I can tell you that her grandmother held to the same place. So when I get older and I become interested in writing and song lyrics and other things like that, I think actually I'd like to tell people, just to try and explain. I was wildly frustrated when I started reading the books about the Lake District. Apart from a few sort of attempts by people like Wordsworth to write about the people of the landscape there, there's not a lot in there from the people who live there and what they think it is that they live in. So eventually I realised I might have to do that. I couldn't wait for somebody else to do it. I just had to get on and do it myself.
We'll come to that. Time for some music first. Tell me about your second disc and why you've chosen it.
So my second song is A Boy Named Sue by Johnny Cash. And these first two tracks just make me laugh because they remind me of my mum and dad, who in some ways were a very unlikely pairing. My mum was very sort of civilised and bookish and classical. And my dad was just a sort of much more sort of northern, sort of rural working class fella with the sort of taste of that. So he'd sit and watch John Wayne movies, and he loved country and western music, and sit and watch the football, and it was sort of noisy and fun and loved to dance. And I still baffled how my mum and dad got together, but it seemed to work and they seemed to love each other, and this song reminds me of him.
Well, my daddy left home when I was three, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
Johnny Cash and A Boy Named Sue. James Rebanks, you've said that as soon as you could toddle, you would go off with your granddad, Huey, in his Land Rover to do some job on the farm. And he sounds pretty formidable. How would you describe him?
He was formidable, but he was also fun. So he only had one tooth, so he was quite a dull-looking fella. He used to like chew the meat off a lamb chopped like a jackal with this one tooth. But he was the truth is, my grandfather was quite an old-fashioned sort of patriarchal type figure, and I got the best of him. So I'm the blue-eyed grandson who gets dragged round and treated special. And
okay.
It's only later, like 10, 15 years later, I realise he's an absolute rogue, that he wasn't necessarily the nicest person to be married to, or even the best of dads to my own dad. So there was another side to it which maybe not so nice, but as a kid, I just had this really wise old guy that would take me with him everywhere, and he would show me where the foxes went under the fences. He'd explain to me about the swallows going to Africa and coming back to our log shed. And he would teach me about the salmon coming up the rivers in the autumn. And if anything, his mistake was to make me think I was too special. So by the age of about eight, I thought I was like the sort of prince of the world. This man was training me to be something important. And maybe he was, being a farmer. But I loved him dearly. And he was and still in some ways is my hero. And when I think about how I want to look after our land and try and strike some kind of balance between what we need to get from it as farmers and looking after the nature and the wild things on it, then for me he's a really important role model. I want to try and build on what he taught me and tried to be.
I've seen a photograph of you as a kid sitting in front of your dad on a horse wearing a cowboy hat. Yeah. I mean, what are your earliest memories of life on the farm? What were you expected to do?
You basically just follow people around. So I think a lot of like farming people listening to this is you spend your childhood in the back of a tractor sitting on a box of spanners. You're bouncing around here, there and everywhere in Land Rovers. You've been sent to run when they move cattle down the road, fetch them back from a field to the farmstead. Your job is to jump over the wall and then run to get back in front of them before the next house or the next junction. So I did all the things that farm kids do, and I look back and I'm slightly amazed I didn't die, because the health and safety implications of some of those things were insane. But we'd build like these mammoth dens in the hay barns. So it was a good childhood, and there was quite a lot of freedom as well. So we'd like roam all over the place. I had quite a protective mother until I was like 7 or 8 or something like that, and then they just got to a point where she couldn't hold me in anymore. And I realise how privileged that is now. So I was reading an amazing thing the other day that the average kid in Britain spends less time outside now than the average prisoner. And not only is that incredibly screwed up, obviously, now, but it makes me realise how lucky I was that we just roamed all over the place.
And what about your love of reading? When did that begin?
So The truth is, I was never a very bookish kid, but we lived sort of in the middle of nowhere, and there wasn't enough to do. So maybe one night a week we would go to like the local town in Penrith, and we'd try and do donuts in like a big brother's car or somebody's car. Anybody that grew up in the north that was remotely sort of working class or rough around the edges knows that you drove to the local town, you sat there talking about absolutely nothing, parked next to each other with the lights on, and occasionally you'd do a donut like sort of Lewis Hamilton does, where they sort of turn around
put
at the end
brake
of the race.
On, yeah. Skid the car around.
That's right. Some part of this, in theory, was meant to impress young women and get you a girlfriend, but it was like the worst way to impress anybody ever. So that was really boring, and that wasn't my thing. So what do you do the rest of the week? Well, in daylight hours, you can work on the farm and do what you love. But there was like one TV in our house, and like Dad decides what's on TV, so he's watching some boring thing. So eventually that led to me going in like one of the other rooms, and there was a bookcase full of my mother's dad's books, my grandfather, and started reading books. And this is only about 6 or 8 months after I'd flunked out of school, because I wasn't interested in books, and I realised immediately that I loved books, and immediately thought, I want to do this. But just to make it more complicated, I didn't not want to be a farmer. I wanted to be a farmer and write books. And of course, I had no idea how you did those two things.
Well, we'll find out shortly. For now, we're going to go to the music. What's next?
The next track is the theme from the movie Zulu by John Barry. And it reminds me of being 8 or 10 years old and on a sort of rainy Saturday or rainy Sunday, dodging work. I should really have been helping my dad in his version of how we should live. I would sort of sneak off like 8-year-olds do, and I would sit and watch Zulu, and I would memorise all the lines, and I could tell you exactly what Michael Caine says as the Zulus come over the hill and all that stuff to this day. And I love this piece of music. Every time I hear this piece of music, I'm 8 years old again watching that movie in my mum and dad's front room.
The theme from the original soundtrack of the film Zulu, composed by John Barry. James Rebanks, when did you first become aware of what had been written about the Lake District by authors like Wordsworth or Wainwright?
I think I was well into my 20s, really. So I'd loved books for like 10 years or something, but I think somewhere along the way I thought, oh, somebody will have written books about what we do. I'd start going to bookshops and sort of looking through the shelves thinking, it's all the same, it's all Wordsworth or it's all Wainwright. They write some brilliant stuff, absolutely amazing stuff they write. But it's not me, and it's not about me or my people. So I'd grown up watching films like 1960s, what do they call it,
kitchen sink dramas.
Kitchen sink dramas. And I would watch those films, and I knew the history of that people had to stand up and claim that space in the culture to be heard as working class people. So to discover there wasn't really like a rural version of that, I remember thinking, this isn't the whole story. This is just part of the story. This is some dead rich white guy's version of it. How can that be enough? And then I guess I'm a little bit lucky or weird or something, because I end up doing a version of that and people like it.
I mean, you didn't have a great time at school. I think you had to travel 10 miles to get to your secondary school. What was it like?
Yeah, I mean, the nearest I can say is it was a bit like Kez. My memories of school are a bit like being in the Ken Loach film Kez. It was lots of bored kids standing around who didn't think school was anything to do with them. And I remember just thinking, I don't want to be in this place. Why am I in this place? Why are people making me be here? I don't want to be here. No one here cares about me. No one cares about my values or my family. I just want to get out.
And were you different? You know, was there a separation between the kids who, like you, grew up on farms and the kids who didn't?
Most of my best friends were just lads out of the local town that were a bit like I was, a little bit rough around the edges and sort of united by mischief and a sort of sense of humour of what we thought was funny, age 15. And, yeah, I'm not at all proud of it now, but what we thought was funny then was just doing anything that wasn't what the teacher said you should do, or breaking stuff, or just not being where you were meant to be. So literally from the moment I went to secondary school aged about 11, I don't think I ever wrote anything in my maths book till I left 5 years later. And now I can't quite believe how anybody ever got away with that. I mean, I'm very lucky. One of my sisters is a head teacher at school, and I know how all the amazing stuff that teachers can do, and it seems to have changed. But just at that time, in that place, it wasn't good for me. So my way of dealing with that was to be the joker. Usually the one that got caught for doing the really stupid thing. I wish I'd been more mature and big enough to rise above it or find some use in it, but I didn't.
You left at 15 with two GCSEs. What did you think the future had in store for you at that
point? My granddad was very clear, because I had GCSEs in woodwork and RE, so my grandfather combined these two things, and he said I could be a vicar and I could knock the nails into the coffin. This is the only combination of these two things. And to my dad and granddad, school was baffling as well. They didn't really think that had anything to do with us. It was just something you suffered, and then you got out as soon as you could. And the saddest thing I did then, and I'm still ashamed of it now, is... And I think I grew up at the moment where I realised how stupid it was, really, because I had a fantastic geography teacher called Mr. Tarn, and he tried really, really hard to engage me, and he knew I could do school stuff. And in the exam, I thought it would be hilarious to do brilliant answers, or the best answers I was capable of, but do them in all the wrong boxes on the exam sheet. Until about a month later, or whatever it was, 2 weeks later, when we got the exam results, and there was just a look on Mr. Tarn's face that made me feel about an inch tall. And to this day, I just think that was so pathetic. But I think in the moment when he looked at me like that, I thought, do you know what? This joke's on me. It's me that's a clown here. And I left school, and I think I'd got out of my system, really. And in the months that followed, that's why I started reading.
Interesting that you left first, though, and then you had to do it on your own terms.
Yeah, yeah. Do it the hard way.
Let's go to the music. Tell me about your fourth piece today.
Okay, so the fourth song today, I think, is the best bit of poetry about 1980s England. It's called A New England, sung by Kirsty MacComb. And it's absolutely beautiful, and it reminds me absolutely of that time and that place. And it was one of the first pieces of literature, if you like, that I ever fell in love with. There's some lines in this song that I think when I heard them, I thought, oh, that's cool. I wish I could do that.
Kirsty MacComb and New England. James Rebanks, in 1990, you lost your granddad after he suffered a stroke. And because of the farm's finances, your grandparents' bungalow and I think a couple of fields had to be sold. So you and your dad then became responsible for the farm. It sounds like quite a stressful time. How did the two of you get on?
We got on dreadful. So my dad wasn't this sort of politically correct, sort of an American movie, give you a hug type figure. He was a bit rougher and a bit harder than that. And I was this awkward, sort of edgy, pushy 17, 18-year-old thinking I knew stuff and we should do things my way. And he'd only just got out of the shadow of his own dad, so it was just a meeting of a rock and a hard place. So we butt heads quite a lot. I think that's something a lot of people don't have in the sort of modern world, is to have a period where you actually, despite everything, have to work with your dad or work with your granddad. And you see the worst of each other, but you also see the best of each other, and you spend a lot of time together, and you really know who that person is. So even though it wasn't like the best period of my life, I wouldn't have missed it for anything, really. And what happens over time is we sort of work through that. You know, you get through the bits where you have a fight, you get through the arguments, and you start to realise that he's actually a much sort of finer and more decent man than I realised he was when I was 15 or 16. So by the time he died three or so, I'm going to cry, but by the time he died 3 or 4 years ago, he's like my best mate. And he'd mellowed, and I'd mellowed, and the sort of fighting stopped. And one of the things that I'm most pleased about is... Sorry, I'm crying now. Is that I didn't write the book when I was 20, because it would have been the wrong book. It would have been the angry book about my dad. And instead it became a book about how much I love my dad, which is a good thing.
He read it, didn't he?
So Well, when I was writing the book, my dad was dying of cancer, and I was terrified. I thought, what's he going to think? You know, you don't want to upset your dad in the last weeks of his life. So he read a proof of the book about 3 weeks before he died, and I said to my dad, what do you think of it? And he said, well, the dedication bit at the back to me is a bit bloody soppy, which made me laugh. And I thought, well, that's all I'm going to get out of him. So I went to see my mum, and she said, he's not going to tell you, but he cried all the way through. And then I said to my sister, I said, Jane, go and find out what he thought of this book. And she came back, and she said, he's amazed that he comes out of this book as a effing legend. And it was nice, because it had come full circle. He'd grown up, I'd grown up. All the nastiness, all the hard bits, they've all gone. And he's two people who love each other, and it's okay.
In 1995, when you were 21, you met Helen, who would go on to become your wife. Tell me about when you met. How did she change you at the time?
Yeah, so Helen came along just when I needed what Helen brings to my life, really, which is Helen's more grown up than me, more sensible than me, and doesn't butt with any of my nonsense. So 20-year-old me was sort of edging towards being a bit more grown up and was reading a lot, sort of wanting to be a writer, but it wasn't going to go anywhere. And Helen came along and said, look, what the hell are you doing? You've been a jerk. Stop the clowning around thing. So almost overnight I did, much to the disappointment of my friends who enjoyed me being a clown. And I built a life with Helen, and it was a much more sensible life. So Helen said, look, you're brainy, you're bookish, and you're not getting on very well with your dad. You need to go back to school. So I did. I went back and I did classes at nights at an adult education college in Carlisle. And I was really lucky. I got some amazing teachers who, within like 2 weeks, are like, what are you? Like, where did you come from? You've read everything. And I'd read like hundreds of books, history books and things. And every time the teacher asked a question, I was like super keen, like put my hand up. So I had this teacher who I still owe a great debt to. He said, you need to apply to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And this is hilarious to me because I have no A-levels and two bloody GCSEs. And that guy helped me to not only to apply to Oxford, but to go and have an interview. And I got in without even finishing my A-levels, which is insane.
Time to hear some music. Tell me about your fifth disc today and why you've chosen it.
There's a common theme through a lot of these songs, which is just amazing lyrics. And somebody who's songwriting I really admire is Jarvis Cocker. And this song is Lip Gloss by Pulp. And I can very distinctly remember being like 20 years old, putting a dry stone wall up on a field on our farm, and it's like a really sunny day in July, and there's lots of swifts swirling around above me, and listening to the words and thinking, I'm gonna do that, I'm gonna write something, I'm gonna do it.
You're looking thin, but all that you live on is lip gloss and cigarettes, and scraps at the end of the day, when it's given the rest to someone with long black hair. Nights and making such a mess of the bed. Oh, you never ever want to go home. And you want you, so you may as well hang around for a while. Call your dad on the phone. He changed his mind last Monday, so you gotta leave by Sunday, yeah.
Pulp and lip gloss. So tell me, James Rebanks, what made you decide that you wanted to go to university in your mid-20s?
I wasn't really sure that I did, to be honest, but I had this teacher that pushed me in that direction to apply, and one of the historians I liked the most, I liked his writing the most, was this guy called A.J.P. Taylor, and he taught at a college in Oxford at Magdalen College, and I thought, well, they probably won't let me in, but I'll go and have a day looking at like the college where he taught, at least I'll know where it was. So I went down and had an interview, and it was... they do this interview thing where they try to rough you up, but I was like in my mid-20s by then, and like no one was going to rough me up, so I just give them back as good as I could, and about two-thirds of the way through the interview, I could just see them smiling, like they were amazed. I think they were baffled where I'd come from, because I was quite different from the sort of typical kid that goes to Oxford, and I came out of the room, yeah, and I just thought, yeah, they were lapping that up.
You knew you'd got in.
They're going to let me in. Still, even then, when I had this letter in my hand, I thought, well, do I do it? I'm so attached to where I live that it was like a wrench for me. If I go there, does that mean I no longer belong here?
And what did you think the reaction from your friends and family would be?
I thought they'd either be baffled or they'd think I'd sort of turned away from them or something. And I got a massive surprise that they were all actually really proud of me. They were like, giving me hugs and things, and like they felt like it reflected well on them. I remember having a conversation with my dad like a couple of days later where I said, like, am I going to go and do this? And he's like, you idiot. Of course you're going to go do it. I don't need your help on this farm. You're a pain in the ass anyway. Go and do it. So I went. Of course, the downside of that is you, a few days later, you're in like this incredibly posh college in Oxford where you don't know anybody. And
what was that like?
It was kind of okay, but I was just like, it's like another planet to me. I don't know people like that. I don't speak like that. I didn't know what any of the words meant. I couldn't even get myself around the college because I didn't understand what people were saying. I don't know what a quad is. I don't know what Michaelmas term means. All this sort of posh language that it all works with. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was just baffled for a few weeks. But also there were amazing tutors there. There were like a couple of people that just realised what I was, which was a bit rough around the edges and a bit green. But I could do what I was there to do. So I had an amazing tutor called Ewan Green. He was a professor of history, and he was just really, really good. After about 3 or 4 weeks, I'd been getting 2 ones, which I have to translate in my head is like a B in anybody else's sort of schooling. And I went to see him and I said, look, I didn't come here to get Bs. How the hell do you get firsts? And he said, you're writing like you're one of them. I want the you version of this. Write your essays like you're you, where you came from and what you're about and what your values are, and find your own voice. And it's one of the best pieces of advice anybody ever gave me. And he also said, go in and have a couple of beers before you write your essay. He said, I'd like a much rawer version of you. And if you're mad about something that we're writing about, tell me what you're mad about. Let it go. Let it out. And I did. And from like that week to when I left, I got like first in every essay with his help and sort of guidance and pushing me along.
And how did you do when you left? How were your grades by then?
I got a double first. Still slightly embarrassed about that. It feels odd that I got that.
I enjoyed making you say that.
I shouldn't be embarrassed about it. I worked hard for it, and it's as good as you can do that. And then I didn't know what to do. Like, I wanted to go home really, really badly. But you're not supposed to go to Oxford and then go back to Cumbria to work on a sheep farm.
Well, I mean, what did you do? How did you deal with missing home?
I used to call it pretend shepherding. So I would like get up at like half past 6, 7 o'clock, and I would walk around the parks of Oxford for no other reason than that's what my body thought I should be doing, which is being outside. You've got the wind or the rain or whatever, and it was like my way of dealing with the adjustment. And then I didn't spend very much time there, so they only have 3 or 8 week terms in Oxford, so I was home more of the year than I was there. And I was going home at weekends if there was any like sheep sales and things. So some of my friends, some of them didn't even realize I'd been to Oxford. I would come home and I'd be at a sheep sale, and they would say things like, I thought you'd gone to, and then they'd just go, whatever, and we'd just carry on as normal. I think a lot of people go to those universities and it changes their life and it gives them a set of friends and it changes who they are. But for me, it wasn't really that. I wanted to do the academic part of it. I wanted to show that I could do it and prove that I could do it. I'd already found Helen and I had friends that I liked and admired at home. I didn't want to be this sort of new, southern, posh, go to London guy. That wasn't me.
Let's have some music. Why have you chosen this 6th disc?
So the 6th song that I've chosen is Way Over Yonder in the Minor Key by Billy Bragg and Wilco. And I chose it for a really simple reason. I have 2 or 3 songs that I play late at night when I'm trying to psych myself to write. And when I was writing my book, The Shepherd's Life, I played the song over and over again because I don't want to think about anything. I just want it to sort of get me in a rhythm. And the chorus where he sings, Ain't Nobody That Can Sing Like Me, is helping me somewhere in my head. It's making me think, go on, you can do this. Just try. Just go. And that's what this song does for me.
She said it's hard for me to see how one little boy got so ugly. Yes, my little girlie, that might be, but there ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key. There ain't nobody that can sing like me.
Billy Bragg and Wilco, Way Over Yonder in a Minor Key. James Rebanks, so you graduated with that double first in history and then returned back to the Lake District from Oxford. How certain were you that you and Helen would continue to farm and bring up your family there?
The truth is, not very certain for like another 10 years after that. The problem on the farm was we didn't have a farmhouse on what was my grandfather's farm, and that was my dream. And I had 2 options, really. I almost convinced myself that if I became a really horrible banker in London, I could earn a fortune in like 5 years. That wasn't credible because I had no skills that were useful for that. And then the other theory was I'd just go home and whatever sort of white-collar office stuff people did that paid enough for you to buy a house in a village near to where we lived, I would do. And I did. I did all sorts of things for 4 or 5, nearly 10 years. And then eventually I became interested in the economics of historic places. And to this day I'm really interested, like, particularly in tourism and how little money from tourism goes to local people. And I ended up with a weird other life where, until very recently, I was advising UNESCO about how tourism works in places around the world, and particularly how you can change and adapt tourism so that more money goes to poorer people in places in Africa or Asia.
It is very interesting because, obviously, you know, your experience and your roots are very local and particular, but actually that issue is global. It's something that affects people all around the world. Did you find commonalities that surprised you?
Yeah, well, it wasn't really part of the job, but maybe 80% of the places I went to were very rural, and the people in all of those places were recognisably like my people. So I had all sorts of funny experiences. Like, I went to Tanzania, and I remember being in this room, and on one side of the room were the Maasai people, and on the other side of the room were the park managers. And I quickly realised that I had to make my mind up which side you need to engage with, and the problem was that they couldn't get the Maasai people interested in the conservation message that we're there to talk about. So I just told them about my life at home, and I could see the defences drop immediately, and the Maasai women were talking to the Maasai men, and as soon as I stopped talking about who I was and why I'd come, they came to see me immediately, and they said they wanted to show me their cattle and they wanted to show me their sheep. And it was, so there was that, just like a shared bond there that was really useful. And there were all sorts of really complex, big issues. But yeah, it's been good because it was like a third sort of education. I'd had a sort of farm education, then I'd had this sort of bookish schooling education. And then maybe the third part of what makes me is those years that they sent me all over the world to these odd places. And then to realise that people all around the world are grappling with the same things, how they hold on to their past at the same time as moving into the future, how they live in places sustainably, how they eat, how they relate to animals, how they relate to the environment. These are common things all around the world that people are grappling with. And having grown up grappling with them in the Lake District, it was quite familiar territory to me, and I was able to do that job as well as I could.
Your book, The Shepherd's Life, was published to great acclaim in 2015, and it came about as a result of your presence on social media. You started tweeting about your life as a shepherd. What made you decide to do that?
Actually, all the good things that have happened in my life have not really been intentional. And using Twitter was the same. I didn't really want to do it. Sort of various friends had tried to persuade me that I would be good at it and I should tell people about what we did on social media. And eventually I did. I gave in, and some of them persuaded me to post pictures. And I remember it was a sort of light bulb moment. I couldn't really believe that there were so many people interested in our mundane day-to-day work, like what the dogs were doing, what the sheep were doing. Yeah, and I have a simple rule on that, which is I'm not really on it. It's all about the sheepdogs, the sheep, the landscape, some of the sort of conservation stuff that I care about. And before you know it, you've got like 100,000 people around the world following that. And I don't think I'm terribly important, but I think what's good about that is we've become far too disconnected, haven't we? People in towns and cities have become far too disconnected from the countryside and the land and farming and what happens in farming, and vice versa. And I think what I really like about people talking to farmers on social media is it's bridging that again. So people can say, hang on a minute, what are you guys doing in these fields? I don't like this. I'm worried about it. And the farmers can kick back and say, well, actually, you made me do it because you buy food too cheap in a supermarket and you don't care about the things that my grandfather cared about. So it's a good conversation. It's awkward at times, and people have all sorts of legitimate concerns about farming, and I wouldn't ask people to not have those. But I think we need to talk to each other, don't we? Even when it's difficult.
Let's go to the music. What's your 7th disc today?
Chateau Lobby No. 4 by Father John Misty. And I just chose it because I love it. It's one of my favourite tracks.
Am I its bread and butter? Like the queen would have ostrich and cobra wine, we'll have satanic Christmas Eve and play piano in the chateau lobby. I've never done this, baby, be gentle.
Father John Misty and Chateau Lobby Number 4. James Rebanks, fewer people are involved in your kind of farming today than they were when you were growing up. How do you see the future of the family farm?
A lot of I don't know answers in this interview, either. So I genuinely don't know. So I have two daughters and two younger sons, and they all love the farm, and they have childhoods a bit like mine where they roam around all over the place, and you look out the window and my kids are about a mile away with them. climbing trees and falling off rocks and things. So I've no doubt that they love that place and it's part of who they are. I don't know if any of them want to be farmers. That'll be their choice when they get older. And I don't know whether they'll be able to afford to be farmers, because a farm like ours makes very, very little money unless we're very clever about how we do things. To me, it isn't about forcing anybody to carry on forever. It's more about, I felt like I was given this gift of experiencing that and knowing it. And I like the idea I can give my kids that experience. And if they end up, I don't know, if they end up in a rock and roll band and they live in New York or something, well, that's great. They'll still have some amazing memories of that childhood and where they came from and the values of the people that they came from. And if they want to be farmers, then I've got a major headache. I've got to work out how to do something on our farm that keeps it going. And the big obsession we have at the moment on the farm is I care very much about adapting the farm to be as good for nature and as sustainable as we can possibly make it. So the kids help us to plant trees and hedges and things like that. We're just doing the best we can. But the truth is we need the British public to back good farming. Small family farms that do the right things and look after animals well, look after the land as well as they can. We need everybody listening to programmes like this to go in the shops and ask for the right stuff and avoid the wrong stuff.
And what is the right stuff and wrong stuff? People are sitting there with pens awaiting instructions.
I read a thing by Michael Pollan, the American food writer, recently. He said you shouldn't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognise as food. And I think that's true. So for our health and for all sorts of other reasons, we need to eat less processed food. And I know that's difficult because people are living on modest incomes and they're really busy and mums are working and dads are working and it feels like there's no time. But we're going to get in a real mess unless we have a food culture that respects good, healthy, simple ingredients, ideally produced as locally as possible. And everybody can't go to a nice posh middle class farmer's market or farm shop. That isn't everybody's reality. But to the greatest extent you possibly can, wherever you live, try and buy from local farmers, try and buy from people who have high welfare standards. So look for things like the Red Tractor badge, which isn't perfect, but which is better than nothing. Or look for organic food, or try to the best extent that you possibly can in your busy and hard up lives to try and get closer to the farmer and buy directly from them. We've got to try and keep these things as short as we can.
Tell me about your eighth disc today.
Okay, so my eighth track today is Mississippi Goddamn by Nina Simone, who I just love. I think she's so tough and raw and brilliant all at the same time. And I love the story behind this track. So Nina Simone's story is amazing. There's some amazing books and documentaries about her, but she sort of had it made. She had a really successful career singing to sort of quite affluent white audiences and singing sort of music that they liked. But she cared deeply about the civil rights struggle in America and a lot of the injustices in American society. And she wouldn't bottle it and she wouldn't keep quiet. Some of her management wanted her to. So she got mad and she started writing songs that reflect getting mad. And this is one of the best of them. And not only the lyrics amazing, but they're raw and angry. And I just love her. I love the fact that she had the guts to potentially throw it all away and risk everything to fight for the things that she believed in. And she was brilliant.
Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. Picking the cotton. You're just plain rotten.
Nina Simone and Mississippi Goddamn. James Rebanks, with all the skills you've got to deploy on the farm, I expect you are going to thrive on our desert island. What do you think would present the biggest challenge to your survival there?
I think homesickness, but I'm going to tough it out. And I think my way of doing that, which might not please my family and friends, is I'm going to forget about home and I'm just going to knuckle down. And goddamn it, I'm going to make this island thing work.
What are we talking? Small farmstead? Is there going to be some sort of,
well, some of my
flock? What's going on?
Some of my friends insist that I have to take a sheep as my luxury item, but that's not happening.
We better
look after the ecosystem of this desert island. The truth is, when I watch people on these sort of reality TV programs where they go to islands, I think, oh, what are you doing? Kill a pig. Go and explore. Go and work out where the fruit is. Work out where the water is. I think I'm just going to go hyper practical and know every inch of this island and work out how the best way to live on it is.
Away from the practicalities to the things that will make your time there bearable, I am sending you away with the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible, and you get to choose another book to take with you. What's it going to be?
I don't really want those two, is the truth of it. But my other book that I'm going to take with me is one of the books I fell in love with when I was 17 years old, which is The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. And I can't think of a better book about the sea than that.
You can also have a luxury item. What counts as a luxury up on the fells, I wonder?
I couldn't think of a luxury item, but I just want something to write with. That's what I am. I'm a guy that does stuff and writes about it. So I want an endless supply of paper and pen so I can just work on my poetry, work on my sea writing, keep some kind of journal about what's happening and, yeah, I want to write.
Done. And finally, one last choice. Which of these 8 discs would you choose to save?
I'm going to take the Kirsty MacColl, A New England, because I just love it. And it reminds me of home and in the rare moments where I will let myself think about England when I'm on this desert island, I think that would probably bring me back more than anything else.
James Rebanks, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I love talking to James. His joy in what he does and where he lives shines through in everything he says. It reminds me of many happy holidays in the Lake District when I was little. Over the years, several farmers and people who are focused on the land have been cast away. The founder of Riverford, Guy Singh Watson, the CEO of the Soil Association, Helen Browning, and the vet and writer whose books inspired the TV series All Creatures Great and Small, James Herriot. You'll have heard James refer to the legendary writer and illustrator of the pictorial guides to the Lakeland Fells, Alfred Wainwright. He was in his 80s when Sue Lawley cast him away in 1989. Alfred wasn't happy travelling far from his home, so the interview took place in Manchester, and only on the condition that he could visit Harry Ramsden's fish and chip restaurant near Leeds afterwards.
You're 81 years old now. Do you still walk a lot?
No. No, unfortunately, my eyes have gone in the last 2 or 3 years. And, I mean, I always counsel people to watch where they're putting their feet on these rough mountain tracks. Now, the last time that I did a fell walk, it was a pouring wet day, terrible wet day. And I was stumbling and slipping all over the place. And it wasn't because my glasses was misted. It was because I couldn't see where I was putting my feet. And that's the last time I did a fell walk. And the mountains wept tears for me that day. It never stopped raining. Latterly, I've been more engaged in writing than walking.
Well, you'll be able to sit on the desert island, Mr. Wainwright, and go for all these walks in your head because you know them all so well.
Yes.
Have you ever been abroad, by the way?
No, I've never been on a ship or an aeroplane. I hate going south from Kendal. I've no ambition to travel abroad. I couldn't face the customs and the new currency and the foreign language and the foreign food and the passport.
Well, you're going to face none of that in being cast away because we plonk you directly onto the desert island, you see, and you will sit there in the tropical sunshine. Is that all right?
Would there be anybody to look after me?
Nobody.
Because I can't look after myself. I've always been well looked after. Would there be chip shops on the island?
Nope.
No, well, I'd be dead in a month. Malnutrition.
Alfred Wainwright asking some important questions and speaking to Sue Lawley, and the whole programme really is worth listening to. Of course, you can also hear James's hero, Jarvis Cocker, in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue too. Next week, I'm casting away the poet Wendy Cope. Do join us then.
Hello, I'm Tez Ilias, and I'm here to tell you about my podcast, Tez Talks. It'll make you laugh, cry, and even question the cultural choices you have historically made. You can subscribe to Tez Talks on BBC Sounds.